So we're the last panel of the afternoon, and that means we're the only thing that's standing between this audience and some very nice reception food that's out the back door. So that puts a particular responsibility on us to be, I think, very insightful and focused in our comments. Knowing our three panelists as well as I do, I know that's not going to be an issue, and we're going to have an enormously interesting discussion. So let me welcome Rajiv Ankaya from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Karen Remley, who's the State Commissioner for Health in the state of Virginia, and Mike Merson from Duke University. And what we've asked Rajiv and Karen and Mike to comment on this afternoon is their own experience and how they've seen U.S. global health investments impact on our own national well-being. I mean, we've heard a lot about this theme throughout the discussion today. We've heard about the security rationale for health, and we've heard a little bit about how there's been tension between the security rationale and the humanitarian imperative. What we'd like to do in this last conversation is actually get past that either-or debate to really focus on two very basic questions, just to hear from each of them in their personal, professional experiences, which are quite different and quite broad. How have they seen global health better help protect and preserve America's national interests? And then secondly, how do we tell that story better? How do we tell it in more concrete and credible and effective terms to the American people? So Rajiv, please, let's start with you.
Thanks, Lisa. And I want to thank CSIS for hosting the event today. I think it's been a great discussion. I am going to frame my remarks around my experience prior to the Gates Foundation when I was in the U.S. government, although this is informed by my experiences in global health since joining the foundation. There's no question that the U.S. government has made a number of investments that enhance the security of U.S. citizens through its work in global health, and I would just highlight a couple. The first is around surveillance to provide early warning of outbreaks of emerging infections, and potentially early warning of deliberate events. There are investments at CDC to increase surveillance capacity, including laboratory capacity, human resources in countries to enhance surveillance. Investments at USAID, principally in capacity building, through the State Department, the cooperative threat reduction efforts. And I would say a whole host of efforts at agriculture, USTR, and elsewhere that I think have been quite valuable in enhancing our surveillance capability. The pandemic preparedness effort certainly accelerated many of those efforts because we were facing a quite significant potential threat in H5N1 that if it were to evolve into a virus that could be easily transmissible between humans, could become quite a kinetic event that would result in quite significant morbidity and mortality in the human population. And I think we saw a massive movement, not only in the US government, but in governments around the world, to quickly enhance capacity for early warning and response. And the US government had a critical role to play there, a leadership role. Finally, I would say that the US government, through its investments in increasing vaccine production capacity in developing countries, has worked to enable other countries to serve their own needs, their own populations, with assets that are within their borders. And the reality is that that was done out of enlightened self-interest, that if you were to have an outbreak of, say, a novel influenza virus, and countries around the world were demanding or asking for vaccines, and the US and other rich countries were the only ones getting vaccines, that would present a tremendous problem, diplomatically, politically, ethically. And so the US, through the WHO, along with a few other donors, made investments to tech transfer capability to countries to help them be more prepared. So I think all of those investments have been quite valuable, and there are many more. But I do want to reflect one bias that I have around this whole security issue as it relates to global health. I think you can make an effective case around something like pandemic preparedness that investments in global health help our population, principally through early warning and response. But it does bother me a bit when the pendulum swings away from the security considerations and we focus more on the good that comes of global health investments, which I think is right, but then we come back to the security argument because there's been a change in the political dynamic in Washington. I actually don't think it works very well to say all of these things that we've been doing actually service security needs. Let's be candid. Those investments, in most cases, were not made to service security needs. And I think, taken to its extreme, it can be a bit disingenuous to try to tell policymakers that this is why we should maintain these investments. If we are going to invest in capacity to provide us with early warning, then let's make that an outcome measure of those investments. Now, if you go to most developing countries, they're not going to care at all that you're investing in an effort because you want early warning for your citizens. And in fact, that is not the way to approach another country with a proposition for an investment in capacity building. What you need to do is you need to make investments in capacities that are relevant to that country's health policymakers and health delivery system. But if you're smart about it, you can do it in such a way that services national needs in country, but also indirectly supports our early warning and response needs. And I would say the nexus of these two drivers, supporting national country needs as well as our domestic needs, is the international health regulations. And here we have a document that has been vetted by 193 member states in the World Health Organization that requires countries, all countries, to sign up to certain requirements in terms of early recognition, identification, reporting, and rapid response to outbreaks of infectious disease. It is not something that is linked to security considerations, but if you get the IHRs right, then you've taken care of much of your security concerns. So I think, I mean, my one recommendation around this issue of security and global health is that we think about ways to build in IHR compliance, for instance, as an outcome measure of investments that we make in global health. I don't think this is going to require a dramatic shift in the way we make those investments, but it will help us to make a much more effective and better case to policymakers that those investments are, in fact, helping our domestic supporting our domestic interests.
Thanks, Rajiv. Please, Mike.
I think Rajiv said it right, that we really need to think about the security argument and realize that there are a lot of important priorities in global health that may not be seen as security-related, like chronic disease, like road accidents, like strengthening of health systems. And I think, as an academic, I took the time over the weekend to look for some good articles to show me the evidence that putting emphasis on security putting emphasis on health would guarantee security. In fact, we don't have a lot of good documentation. The intuitive argument is very strong. And I think we heard a lot today about why we want to invest in health for our security. We know that poorer populations are more likely to, perhaps because they're disenchanted, turn to terrorist organizations. We've seen some of our other countries like Cuba and China, certainly Hamas and Hezbollah, use health as a way of gaining the popularity of populations. So I don't mean in any way to dismiss the intuitive argument. But I do feel that we need as more empirical evidence for this. It would be helpful to convince policymakers that investing in health really helps our security. But at the same time, realize that global health should not only be seen as global health security. And that was the point I think, Kevin, you were making before with the new global health. So I think it's an important balance between our stress on security, which is very helpful politically, but at the same time recognizing that there's a wider global health agenda. Also, we have to remember that not all our developing partners, country partners, see security the way we might see it. And I use the example, of course, of the fight that occurred over the H5N1 strains, where our Indonesian colleagues didn't quite see our definition of security, their definition of security. So I think it's a delicate balance that I think we all need to think about. And those of you who have the awesome responsibility of leading our nation's effort, I'm sure think about this, and I encourage you to do so. The AIDS drugs, The AIDS drug scenario is an interesting one because here we are in a very interesting position with AIDS treatment. Meadover has called it the threat position of the US government in the sense that we are treating thousands of people with antiretroviral drugs. Now, there are people who think that's a good thing. People will like us better. But on the other hand, there are some who think that eventually Mead himself thinks that there will be resentment eventually built up over this so-called threat position. And even Princeton Lyman has talked about the fact that it constrains our foreign policy to some extent to have so much invested in AIDS treatment. So I think these are very interesting times and very interesting challenges that we face around the issue of security. And the last point I would make is, I've been sitting here today over 40 years working in global health, thinking what an exciting time it is. I can't think of a more exciting time in the history of global health, where there's so much commitment and desire to do well in our country. And if I were to think about what I would feel are the greatest threats to being successful, one is that we're not a partner. I think we should listen again to what Kevin said about the fact that having worked in WHO for 20 years, I know that there are many countries around the world that just don't think the way we think. And so our great, great challenge is to be a partner and both with our countries around the world who have money, donor countries, UN agencies, but also with governments. So I've heard a lot about that today. But you know, we have to remember that national priorities sometimes are not going to be our own priorities. I mean, use the example of water and sanitation. You go to Haiti today, and their major preoccupation is clearly cholera, as it should be, not something in GHI per se. So I think the stress on countries is really important, and then the strengthening of health systems. We're never going to be able to adequately combat pandemics if we don't have health systems. And I think the decision by PEPFAR for the MEPI program is really groundbreaking in that you enlisted universities from around this country to help PEPFAR in training thousands and thousands of new workforce in Africa. And then lastly, of course, our success has to be documented. And you know, there's a lot of talk about documentation and outcomes, but that's tough. And we really need to invest the resources and develop the tools to be able to do that.
Thanks, Mike. Please, Karen.
Well, I think I'm in this unusual position where I spent the first part of my career in international health, which is now global health, and now I'm in a subdivision of global health, which I would call the domestic health. And we need domestic health initiative as much as we need global health. When I watched the video, I emailed myself a note to SD for it so I could show it to my local health directors. Because in our local health departments, there's the WIC clinic and the family planning clinic and the immunization clinic, and they're all on different days, and moms can spend every single day of the week coming to the health department to get care. And I use that analogy because I think what I see over and over again is the incredible linkages that occur. We have many areas in our country where we have infant mortality rates in the 20s. We have maternal mortality rates that are going up in some parts of our countries, not the way they are in many other countries in the world, but similar problems, and that we need to share the innovation, the huge changes and leaping forward in how we deliver care. But I look at, and we talked about on Thursday, I get to go meet with Senator Warner and Senator Webb and all my Congress people, and one of the things I'll talk with them about is our health is global health. How many of you flew in through Dulles sometime in the last year or another international airport? Well, at least once a month, Dulles gets a communicable disease that comes through. Normally, we don't find out until 4 or 5 days later when the 23-year-old who was an au pair develops measles, and she's done what I call the plane, train, automobile infection. We involve CDC. We involve the manager of Dulles. We involve all the different airlines. We look at all the manifests. We go out and we talk to, last time it was 6 states that were involved. Think about the amount of money that just got spent. And if I always say, if I could take that $1 million case and invest that in vaccines over and over again. And the interesting thing is we talk about private partnerships. This is the first time where the manager of Dulles called me and said, what can I do? I'm tired of this. And I said, you know, you can work with your colleagues internationally and start to vaccinate their employees. It's a place to start to have that discussion across infrastructure, across what affects commercial activities. But I also think there's some successes that I'll tell Warner and Webb about and everybody else, is that when H1N1 happened, you know, I still think the infectious disease doctor in Mexico that raised his hand and said, I think there's something going on, deserves a Nobel Prize of some kind. But it was the fact that they'd been working closely with the CDC and they felt comfort between those two countries having those types of discussions, learning what was going on in Kenya. As we looked in large populations with endemic flu, what was different with H1N1, we all learned. And through H1N1, when I now have a multi-drug-resistant TB case that comes from another country, I can pick up the phone, or my epidemiologist can, and say, what are you guys seeing? What are you seeing in that area? This person came from this village. And we're all of a sudden having those conversations around the world that we didn't have before. So when I look at it from an economic stability for my state, I look at it for security for my state. We have more active duty military than anywhere else in the United States. All of the work we do globally directly impacts the health of the 8 million people I'm responsible for and makes a big difference. And I think we have to always bring it home to everybody. It's not only do you want to save those 8 million children, but they're the children that could be your children, that could be the children next door. And so I kind of, you know, we talk about outbreaks. It's kind of that herd immunity idea that there is no longer a domestic herd and a global herd. We're all one big herd. So, you know, we talk about wanting to be able to find that outbreak, but I would bet a hot fudge Sunday that we're not going to find it until it's already here. Because, you know, how many people are flying into the United States every day? So our ability to really catch that rapidly progressive outbreak is going to be hard. The people with dengue fever who come from Haiti, they volunteered in Haiti or their military, I now have dengue fever in my state. So I'm really careful looking at my mosquito population and what's going on, because I never dreamt that I'd be thinking about dengue in my state, but we're starting to go back and ask for more money about mosquito control. So I think these things are so connected, and sometimes we lose that connection, and we need to really reinforce that to people every day, that it's not just that those people are across the ocean. They are you and you are us, and we need to work together on that.
So we promised you panelists with three very different perspectives, and they certainly have that. But let me come back to different elements that you each raised in your conversation. And I'd like us just to look forward maybe out to the next sort of 10 years and think a little bit about, you know, what are the tools and capacities and skills that we need to strengthen, or maybe we don't even have right now, we need to create to help us better deal with some of the issues you just raised. I mean, Rajiv, you talked about implementation of the international health regulations, and Mike, you talked about the lack of empirical evidence and the need to strengthen partnerships. And I liked very much, Karen, the way you said we need to bring this home more mm-hmm. effectively. So it'd be really useful, I think, for all of us to hear your thoughts on, you know, what do we need to do to strengthen our ability to execute on each of those three areas that you've identified as potential weaknesses for moving us forward?
Well, I can start. I mean, I think we have many of the tools that we need. It's just a matter of making the right investments and working closely with partners in country. I mean, CDC in particular has a remarkable track record of partnering with national governments in country on their terms to train their people in the nuts and bolts of epidemiology, laboratory technology, so that they then have the ability to detect and respond to diseases that are relevant for their populations. We just need to do a lot more of that. So it's not rocket science. It's just the, I mean, and there's no, you know, way you can flip a switch and make it happen overnight. It takes people spending time in countries for sustained periods of time to build up the trust and to have this exchange of knowledge. I guess there are some things that we can do on the technology side that I wouldn't want to lose sight of. And this isn't directly relevant to the point I made about preparedness and response, but I just have to point out that the way the world typically operates is that We have amazing technologies that are made available to populations in rich countries. And they take years or decades, 27 years in the case of the hepatitis B vaccine, to get to populations in poor countries. This is what we can expect unless we try to deliberately do things differently. And so when we think about some of the vaccines that Amy was referring to, you know, these are tools that children in this country have had access to for several years, and now and we just don't have the money to get them out to countries where they're really needed. And the irony is that you've got a tool here that frankly isn't as helpful in the U.S., yet it's readily available, as it is in a place where you have significant incidence of childhood pneumonia and diarrhea. And this is what Tachi was talking about when he talks about time working against us. You know, every day that goes by that we're not making the necessary investments to get those vaccines to those kids in those countries translates to thousands of children dying. And so I think that there is an element here of changing the paradigm and accelerating access to these critical life-saving and prolonging technologies that we need to focus on.
Karen. I couldn't agree more. I do think that one of the things we need to do, and we've got our colleague who is one of our commissioners from Exxon, getting the private sector, as they move into countries, as we expand markets, to really understand preventive and primary intervention in health is just the cheapest thing you can invest in for your employees is huge. You know, we deal with a very large, I don't know what it would be, large box company that opens up huge stores, and in rural parts of the South, a lot of endemic disease. And when you can convince them that primary intervention, doing TB skin tests on employees when they come from multiple different countries to look for them will save them money, will make a big difference. But I think all of the work we do, we need to remember where there are emerging economies, you've got to engage, and I think it was said so well earlier, the private sector to put those primary prevention interventions, those vaccines up front first. That's the most important thing you can do as you start to develop a community, is to really focus on those prevention, maternal child health, vaccines first before they do other things. And then they'll just have a substantive impact faster.
Three quick things. Going back a little bit to what I said before, we have billions of dollars we're investing, you know, far greater magnitude than we ever had. We have a lot at stake in being successful. I really would encourage and urge us to put money into evaluation. That doesn't mean 1%. Usually it's 3, 4, 5% of our budget into evaluation. It will be a shame if we don't do that and we don't document our success. Because more success will breed more resources, hopefully. And we would be in really good shape at a political time like this if we had the kind of data that I know must be out there to document what we've achieved. Secondly, on the health and security issue, try to find empirical situations like the AIDS drugs to show how investing in health has helped security. As I've said, in reviewing what's out there, there's not a lot of empirical evidence. I think it would be really helpful to have it challenge some universities to get people to look at this. I think it can only help because I think the intuitive argument is very strong. I just think it would be good to have the empirical data. And my last comment is, sitting where I do in a university now, take advantage of all the young people that really want to do global health. Mm-hmm. Just for a second on this, there are now, in our last survey, something like 250 universities in this country that have something going on in global health, at least 100 of which have very serious efforts in education, in centers, and institutes. This involves, you know, thousands of students, faculty, and the like, wanting to help and trying to channel that energy into our national effort is something I think we barely touched the surface on. But there are people out there wanting to do more if you could help find a way for them to do it.
Mike, thank you for bringing us to a close on that inspiring note. I think there are many more questions we could go back and forth on, but we're approaching the bewitching hour here. So I think I'm going to invite our chair, Helene, back up to offer a few closing thoughts.
Well, am I on? Yeah, I'm going to be very, very, very brief because this has been a very full day. I want to, first of all, thank all of our panelists. The panels were fabulous. People were prepared, I think, really shared some insightful comments. And I think it's really been an incredibly rich discussion. So, you know, I really want to thank all of our panelists, some who have already had to leave. But this day, I think, confirms for me the importance of this issue. It confirms how important the U.S. leadership role is in this area and why it is important, even in these very difficult times, for us to stay the course and make sure that these incredible commitments that we have made are kept and that we build upon the foundation that we have in global health and really make sure that we can do a better job. And I think people have said it over and over and over again. We've got to figure out how do we make the case, how do we find the data, how do we talk about what we know works and make that case more and more successfully, because you know it's the right thing to do, as everybody has said, but there's a lot resting on it. There are millions of lives that are resting on whether or not we as the United States can continue our commitment to this area, to global health, for all the reasons that this panel has talked about. So yeah, I think we all leave here today with renewed commitment and hopefully with renewed energy to keep up the good fight and to make sure that the gains that we have had in global health are not lost. So with that, I just want to again say thank you. And John, I don't know if you wanted to say a few words as well in closing, but thanks again to CSIS, to Steve, to Lisa, to Susan, and all who have really done so much to pull this incredible afternoon together.
No service needs two benedictions. So let's just end with that and say thank you to Helene and her team. Refreshments outside. Thank you, everybody.